Alright, time for another DraftPhysics.com. DebatePhysics.com also, but no debaters. Yeah, just can't get anybody on the internet to interact in any kind of constructive way. The troller net. It's just, I don't know. I don't really get it. I don't get the internet. I don't get the human race, I suppose. Because they really just don't seem interested in any of the stuff that's important. And I would even consider interesting. You know, the interesting stuff isn't interesting to them for some reason. But anyway, all right, so we have more of the Wolfram talking about the Eddington experiment. And it's just... I mean, it's just priceless in terms of... nobody can figure out just how... that this isn't any way to build a theory of reality, you know. But whatever. So, let's just play it.
How do you observe the banging of light around the sun? Well, during a total...
Oh, okay. So, this probably has to be fixed. Sorry, audio issues. Always gotta figure out what the best combination is and such. I think that should work. Really should. Very. Yeah, it's weird. I don't have the other audio source. Is it listed here? Damn. All right, I have to fix that, I think. All right, pause. All right, should be working.
For eclipse, the disk of the sun is covered, and so when there's a star that comes just behind the sun, you can see that star.
All right, so this really isn't the Eddington experiment. Okay, so, you know, that's where it starts to go, you know, sideways. You're saying, come on, we can't even describe what Eddington's challenge was realistically. And, you know, so what's the point? You're going to explain to kids and you're not going to explain it right. So, you know, yeah. I mean, this isn't how things should be done. All right, so the problem with the sun is, in spite of the fact that no one talks about it having an atmosphere, it has a gigantic atmosphere. There's tons of crap coming off the sun. A lot of it goes back into the sun, so it's shooting off crap. It goes back into the sun, so it's really cloudy, so to speak, around the sun. And then the other problem is our atmosphere from... You know, you're observing, we have this, you know, whatever, miles of atmosphere around the surface of the Earth. And so the sunlight hits the atmosphere and deflects in all directions. Scatters, right? Scatter. You know, scatters. And so it ends up blinding telescopes, essentially, during the day. They can't look at any part of the sky because they can't see anything. Because there's so much light coming into the telescope, so they only work at night. And so obviously, looking at the sun and watching something that happens to the sun, around the sun, doesn't work from Earth, you know, during the day. And, I mean, when the sun's out. So there's no, you can't do it, you know. And then, the problem is, okay, this huge corona at night is... At night, you can't look at the sun at night, right? It's not possible to look at the sun at night. So you need an eclipse to wipe out the sunlight. Obviously, whatever light's still going through the atmosphere is still going to get all this scattery crap is going to happen. It's not perfect anyway. So, but the whole point would be is that you can't really watch something coming out from this way behind the sun and watch that light getting bent. So, yeah, it's theoretically interesting, but it's not something you're going to do. And so what Eddington's challenge was to take something, okay? So he had to go a whole radius of the sun out here somewhere and say, okay, there could be a star out here somewhere I could look at. And because of the bending of the light, it'll be a little bit, it'll look like it's, you know, it'll look like it's here, okay, when it's really here. Well, it'll look like it's here when it's really here, okay, because of the bending. So the perspective will be a little bit off, and you won't see it where you're supposed to see it. And it was a tiny amount of, it's a really hard experiment to do. Let's understand that the eclipse he was using was a 2 p.m. eclipse, so it's going through more atmosphere, okay? It's not the 12 p.m. eclipse. Later in the day, it gets worse and worse and worse. 2 o'clock's pretty bad, actually. You know, the one we had here in North America in 2017, whatever it was, 19. Perfect 12 p.m. eclipse, and they didn't redo the experiment. Yeah. So the experiment was done. Piece of crap, though, frankly. Never redone, okay? So every other eclipse since then, somebody might have attempted it, but something went wrong, blah, 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 bad weather, bad this, blah, blah, blah. They didn't get good, you know, results. And using inferior technology. So at least Eddington was using a 12-foot-long telescope with a 12-inch, big lens. so he had some advantage. At least he had decent equipment to do the experiment with. And the repeats have been crap. And I don't know why any of the gigantic telescopes have never been able to accomplish it, but none of them have been able to do it from Earth. And the real point I will make is they've never done it from space, where there's 400 times better. You can see 400 times better. 400 times. I mean, a microscope that does 400 times is pretty damn good. You can see the shoes on an ant. You can see the shoelaces. Anyway, all right. So back to the storytelling. So this isn't as dramatic as seeing a star behind the sun. You can't do that because the sun has a giant atmosphere, and it's an atmosphere scattering light. Understand that? Scatter. It's an important function in the universe. And apparently physics just couldn't care less. Okay, anyway. Physicists. What button do I have to hit here? I need my Firefox back. What do you do with it? There it is. Okay. So, leave us continue.
Because you're not blinded by the light of the sun. You can see that star.
So it's, yes, first you're not blinded by the light of the sun. And second, well, that's the first. And then the second, you really have to go outside the corona of the sun. Because even though you've blocked out the sun, the corona is still a big problem.
And you can see, was the apparent position of that star deflected? That would correspond to light from the star having been bent as it goes around the sun. So the question...
All right, so he's going to bring up an interesting fact that, okay, there was first the experiment took place in... the attempt was going to take place in 1916. And they weren't able to pull it off because of the war, World War One. And the funny thing was, is Einstein changed his prediction in those 3 years. So he originally predicted that light would just be bent the amount that every other material object is bent. And that prediction is based on some arbitrary definition of, you know, the quantization of a photon. And so you're going based on its velocity as a way of measuring, somehow or other, you have to measure, you have to give the photon a mass for it to be bent, or you can't use anybody's equations. But anyway, so his prediction was that it would be bent twice as much by the second experiment. It's a dramatic statement. I'm just saying, you know, if I think even in 1905, you know, or any of these, you know, that it would still be kind of a dramatic statement to say, okay, they've already gotten a pretty good indication that magnetism, electricity, and light all move at the same speed. And there's every indication that gravity does the same thing. And that these are all just things you could put in the category of light speed forces. And all of those light speed forces, okay, seem not to be able to interact with each other. So the very fact that you're saying a force can affect another force is a dramatic statement. The fact that you're saying it's affected twice as much as all of the heavy matter is really anti any kind of simple logic. I mean, there's no simple logic that will get you to that conclusion.
Then is what? How much was the light going to be bent? And there was a total solar eclipse in 1916, and there was a whole expedition to go observe the bending of light around the sun and test Einstein's theory. Fortunately for Einstein, that was right in the middle of World War One, and it was, I think it was in Crimea, part of it's geographically in Ukraine.
Speed this up a little. And so it could, they didn't pull off the experiment, the first attempt. I don't know what kind of equipment they had for the first attempt, so maybe it was really a really unrealistic technological experiment to do. Blah, blah, lots of things to say about that.
The thing that, but in any case, it was in the middle of World War One, and needless to say, I think there was some, Americans maybe on this, but I don't really remember the full historical details. But anyway, fortunately for Einstein, the expedition never managed to make an observation there. The equipment was impounded by some, who knows what happened, some messy thing that happened in the middle of a war that was going on around people attempting to observe light being bent around the sun. So fortunately for Einstein, that observation was never made, because at the time, his calculation of what should happen was wrong. And what would have happened is people would have said,
It wasn't, you could say it's wrong, but, you could say it was more rational. And, but whatever. That the light would be bent the same amount as any other material object. So electrons would be bent the same amount as light would be bent. And light would be bent twice as much. Come on, it's a huge difference. A force being bent twice as much by another force. That's a dramatic disconnect from every other physical experiment ever done on forces.
Even if they'd observed light being bent by a factor of two more, they would have said, oops, Einstein's theory is wrong because it predicts something different because the calculation had been done wrong. Okay, well, 1919 comes around. That was after the end of World War One, and a chap called Arthur Eddington, a British physicist, very keen on, sort of bring the scientists together, even if there was a war, we're going to, we British scientists are going to prove that.
So Eddington was somehow charmed by Einstein's theory for whatever reason, and he just happened to have acquired the job of being, the head of the whatever science astronomy department of England. And so he persuaded them to invest. And the funny thing is I think England was hoping they were going to prove Einstein wrong. So I think that's why they paid for the experiment, was to really prove Einstein wrong. So that's sort of the irony. But yeah, Eddington duped them, so to speak.
That German science is predicting good things and so on. We'll do this expedition to South Africa where there was going to be a total solar eclipse, and we'll observe the bending of light around the sun. Probably those experiments were kind of fudged.
Right, so he's conceding that this experimental evidence, that this historical, evidence is kind of crappy. And I can point out how the de Châtelet clay experiments were crap, because they were using round objects and measuring the displacement in the clay, based on how shaped objects penetrate clay, and so it completely depends. If you never get through to the full shape of the object, there'll be a differential between objects that don't penetrate as deeply will have to do more work than objects that penetrate deeper. So you can explain how these are really terrible experiments in terms of how they were interpreted and how much they were used as persuasion tools when they were really just theater. They really weren't good science. And the Eddington experiment wasn't good science. He had crappy data. by his own concession, he would not stake his life on the results. He wrote in his own journal. He got 10% of the quality of photographs. I mean, the whole thing is a sham, is what it should be called. And now they've never redone this critical experiment in terms of proving Einstein right. This made Einstein an international hero. Yeah. That's what it did. That's the truth. Einstein was, you know, not known publicly at all until this experiment.
Probably they couldn't have done experiments as well as they claimed that they were doing them. But in any case,
but in any case, who cares? Crappy evidence? Who cares? We all want to believe, so yeah, good enough.
Yes, that experiment said, great, we found it. We got exactly the result the general relativity would.
Yeah, just like the gravitational wave people. You know, we did it. Okay, it's theoretically really bizarre. You're bouncing a light beam through mirrors 1,600 times, and then you tell me you're going to measure how thick a proton is? That you have accuracy of the thickness of a proton after you've bounced a photon through 1,600 interactions with a mirror? That's not a theoretical challenge. Yeah, come on. This is the whole thing is so ridiculous.
Predict. And so that was sort of a triumph for general relativity. There was another effect.
Yeah, it was a triumph for Einstein and this whole stupid, moronic, idiotic, bizarrely silly wooey religion.
Right. The advance of the perihelion of Mercury. I'll just explain what that is. So when the Earth goes around the Sun.
All right, so he does okay explaining this one. But what he doesn't explain is that all you need is a... Well, I'll wait till he says it.
People say it goes, well, the Earth goes around the Sun roughly in a circle. But it isn't exactly a circle. It's a little bit distorted. It's a little bit an ellipse. And so an ellipse, so the Earth is going around the Sun in an ellipse, okay? But so an ellipse has sort of an elongated semi-major axis and a semi-minor axis. Those are the analogs of the diameter. If it was a circle, the semi-major axis and semi-minor axis would be identical, but they're like the radii, the two different radii of the ellipse. Okay, so when the Earth goes around the Sun, to a very good approximation, the ellipse that corresponds to the Earth going around the Sun is fixed in place. The Sun is here, the ellipse is there, the major axis of the ellipse does not move at all. It's always kept in that the Earth just keeps going around and around and around in this pattern. And that's a feature of inverse square law of gravity. If you have an inverse square law of attraction, that has a special conservation law.
Well, I think it really has to do with the orbit just being in two dimensions, not three, you know, where you're going to tend to orbit all in the same plane because there tends to be more gravity in that plane, which is going to force everything to try to go neutral. But the fact is that everything does have a little bit of a wobble in it. All right, so let me draw this real quickly. All right, should be back. All right, so the ellipse is just this idea. Okay, that, yeah, well, that's exactly the opposite way to draw it, right? It's more like big out here, small here. But anyway, so it's closer to the Sun, okay, as it orbits, right? And these things are a lot, they're not nearly as dramatic as something like that, right? So it's almost a perfect circle, except the circle's a little bit off, so blah, blah, blah. But the point is, okay, so on a plane, what you're really saying is that, you know, the Sun's here and everything tends to want to stay on the plane of all of this extra mass that's going around in the solar system. And so what Mercury's doing is wobbling a little up and down here this way. So as this ellipse is happening, it's tilting and tilting back, tilting, tilting, tilting. And the truth is all of that could be just caused because the Sun is this big giant thing and Mercury is much closer. So the other planets are much further away from the Sun than Mercury is. It's dramatically closer. So let's say the Sun had a little tiny bit of wobble in its own center of gravity. That little wobble would account for
You can just create any kind of mathematical wobble in the sun's mass. And yes, Mercury would feel it, but it would have almost nothing as an effect on the planets further away. And it's just because Mercury is so close that you can just create any kind of little flaw in the movement of the sun, any kind of wobbling this way, would cause Mercury to have that procession where, you know, each time it goes around, it's a little bit off, a little bit off, a little bit off. So it's, yeah, so it's really, it's wobbling in the same plane. Yeah, I just have to think of how to say that. But anyway, so it's just processing. This is moving in a direction, okay, instead of staying in the same place where it tends to with the other planets. And it's just because it's so close to the sun that, like I said, any tiny motion in the center of the sun's gravity would, any, you know, slight procession in the sun's spinning would cause this. You could blame that just as easily. You could make up some mathematics to make that the truth. All right, should be back. So I was thinking that, you know, you don't have to think about this stuff very long, and you think about ideas about what would be the difference between being Mercury and being the Earth or being Saturn or being some other planet. And another feature is that, yeah, Mercury is much closer to all of the energy, the plasma, and all the other crap coming off of the sun. So you could understand how that would break the inverse square law, in the sense that you don't have just gravity in the equation. Gravity is not a pure gravitational relationship, because the sun is actually spewing energy going out. And so you have some force opposing the gravity, which would change the pure inverse square law formula of Newton's. Newton's formula doesn't have any factor for, well, the thing's on fire and it's pushing a bunch of plasma out of it. So, you know, there are reasons why Mercury doesn't obediently, perfectly. I mean, it is, and we're talking about a tiny little difference off of Newton's purely gravitational equation, where, you know, it's a tiny little aberration. You know, so, you know. So Einstein's right, even though Einstein's formula, I've never even seen anybody show us how it actually works. You know, I mean, in the sense that nobody can actually do it and show how, see, this is what Mercury does, and this is how the formula perfectly predicts that. But even if it did, it's doing it because it's contrived. There's some factor in there that's just creating a little bit of counter energy to break the inverse square law relationship. And that's all you're looking for, is anything, sunspots, anything to say, well, that's a change that Mercury's going to feel and the Earth isn't going to feel, because the Earth is too far away. Well, Venus, you could even argue. So, you know, the whole thing is just such crappy science.
That in addition to conserving energy and momentum and angular momentum, things like that, it conserves a thing, the mathematical name, the Runge lens vector, which is basically says that the axis of the ellipse always stays pointed in the same direction. The axis of the ellipse never changes. So that's pretty, in a very close approximation, true for the Earth. Okay, Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, is much closer to the sun. And I should say that if there's a, this is a feature, this preservation of this direction of the major axis of the ellipse is a consequence of an inverse square law of gravity.
Right. So the inverse square law is just the gravity law. Okay, so it's not taking into account anything else the sun is doing. And it also depends on where you place the gravitational body. Okay, whether or not the sun is, in fact, its molten center is perfectly spherical in terms of its rotation. And we don't know that. Yeah.
As soon as there's a deviation from an inverse square law of gravity, it's no longer true. The axis of the ellipse moves over time. It precesses over time. Okay, so for the Earth, very close to an inverse square law. For Mercury, which is much closer to the sun, other effects from the gravity of the sun can come into it, can happen.
So again, he's saying it's the gravitational effects, and maybe it's not gravitational effects. maybe it's because the sun is exploding and producing, you know, tons and tons of other forms of energy.
And so Mercury, in addition to having a 1 over r squared force law for its gravity, has a little bit of 1 over r cubed force law as well. And the result,
which would be a weaker force law. So I don't know. So that's what he says, 1 over cubed. I mean, there's huge difference squared and cubed. It's not a big difference in Mercury. So again, I don't know.
The result of that 1 over r cubed force law is that there is a precession in the ellipse that corresponds to the orbit of Mercury. And the perihelion of Mercury, which is the place on the ellipse where Mercury is closest to the sun, that perihelion will precess. It will move around in successive orbits.
Well, both things are going to move around. So it doesn't, you know, you can't move the perihelion without moving the, whatever it's called, the other helium.
And so that's what the advance of the perihelion of Mercury is, that motion, that change as in successive orbits of the position of the perihelion, the position of the closest approach to the sun for Mercury. And that advance of the perihelion is associated with...
So all you have to do, you could simulate the same thing on with the Earth or anything, any satellite. You put a satellite in an elliptical orbit and you could cause it to do the same thing by just giving it a little push at the right moment. So you just push it at the right moment and you'll create the same sort of precession of its ellipse.
Changes from the inverse square law of gravity. Okay, so the inverse square law is true for a certain a sphere of mass and so on, but there are corrections to it when the gravitational field has deformations. In fact, I already mentioned in talking about dipoles for electric.
So again, you know, this isn't about noted deformations. So what's the deformation in the gravitational field created at Mercury's distance? There's no known deformation. So how did Einstein predict a deformation that still isn't even identified?
Dipoles, there are similar gravitational effects. And so when you see the perihelion of Mercury advancing, it's not completely obvious. It's a calculation. It's a complicated piece of astrophysics to verify that, no, that's not a feature of the shape of the sun. It's a feature of changes in the law of gravity.
Right. And changes based on what reasoning? Why would the inverse square law not work? Because, frankly, Einstein's gravity is a well. The well is symmetrical. Black holes are symmetrical. All these other things are symmetrical. All these other things aren't creating the same side effect that you're saying is being created for Mercury. So if I did make the sun twice as massive or 10 times as massive or a million times as massive and turned it into a black hole, all of a sudden, these little nuances are going to go away, and we're back to mock gravity. We're back to Newton's equations coming up with the same answer.
So that was a little bit of a subtle thing to untangle. But in any case, so one thing that the big sort of message of this is, to make a prediction from a theory requires a big stack of calculations on top of the theory. And sometimes those calculations are hard to do.
Yeah, so I don't see that as there's no big calculations you have to do to find out whether or not the light from a sun is being bent, in the sense that you can just observe it. So that's the point. And that direct evidence doesn't exist. The Eddington experiment hasn't been successfully done beyond the margin of error and all that kind of crap. So, you know, it certainly hasn't been done with superior technology, which is a huge difference.
I mean, famously, in Newton's theory of gravity...
I mean, a huge problem for physics. You don't redo, you don't go backwards. You don't take lesser technology to verify an experiment.
Newton tried to compute the motion of the moon, and he managed to get this position of the apse of the moon, which is basically this perihelion type thing, but with respect to the Earth, he managed to get that wrong by a factor of 2 with his calculations. His theory was correct, but his calculations were wrong. And they were not wrong in that particular case.
Right. So this is all really, you know, complicated, and you got to be really careful and all this kind of crap, and we're shown nothing. We're supposed to be believers, and we're shown none of it. Yeah. That's just a fact.
because he made some arithmetic mistake. They were wrong because it's just really hard to do those calculations. And it took 150 more years before people developed the kind of mathematical tools to be able to do those calculations well and to show that Newton's theory of gravity did correctly predict what had been observed in the motion of the moon.
So again, it's not a very complex theory of gravity. I mean, it's just really the inverse square law. And you're just saying, what else is affecting it? Is gravity consistent or is it inconsistent? And I would argue it's the requirement that it go pretty spherical is pretty much a known fact, and what changes that, you know, is the fact that something can be spinning or there can be some other factor that's going to affect the shape of an object, and if the shape changes, then the gravity changes.
So it's tricky to get predictions from theories that can be tested experimentally. It goes far beyond the actual theory itself.
Right, so it's not tricky if the experiment is simple enough and it'll produce an obvious result. And so in all these cases, you don't prove that it's 1/2 mv squared. You don't show me it taking twice as much fuel to go twice as fast. You don't show me something 4 times higher making 4 times the size hole in the ground. You have the obvious evidence doesn't exist, and all you have is a bunch of calculations that say so. But there's no evidence demonstrating so. And the two-slit experiment, you say it's two waves and they're interfering with each other, yet two waves can't make the complex pattern. It doesn't work. The single slit is completely not intuitive or not connected to waves at all, because I make a single slit in a wave tank and I put plane waves going in, you know, not noisy waves, plane waves. I'm just going to get one wave out. I'm not going to get any interference. You know, I could go on to the radar experiment where I can send the radio this way, where the two signals never interfere, never cross each other. And I'll get the same interference pattern. Somehow the waves interfered with each other when they never touched each other. The evidence doesn't match the assertions at all. This is just really, really crappy science. And it's the foundation of a whole bunch of statements about all kinds of other superpositions and the existence of all kinds of fancy particles and entanglement and all kinds of wacky ideas, and it's all founded on experiments that you never did, and you don't have any evidence that they verify the existence of your axioms. Your axioms are all made up. God exists, therefore the Son of God must be God, because he's the Son of God. And if God is real, he must be real. I mean, the logic is circular and crappy. You never proved God was God.
In our theory of physics, the most impressive and spectacular things that are happening now are what one might call theoretical predictions. You know, there's hundreds of years of physics that have been done, particularly impressive physics in the 20th century. And that have led to conclusions like...
No, so he's saying that this is impressive physics where they just make up a story and they really don't prove it with any good evidence. That's impressive physics. Yeah, I think that's unimpressive. Saying we've done it. We detected a gravitational wave by bouncing a photon through 1600 mirrors.
Quantum tunneling, like general relativity, like these kinds of things. And the question for our theory is, can we use our theory, which has very little that goes into it, and can we do the...
Very little that goes into it, except the made-up axioms that don't really exist. There is no 1/2 mv squared. There is no such thing as wave interference for a photon, okay? You can break its phase. You can change the position of the elements of a photon, so it won't be seen as a photon anymore. But you can't destroy its energy.
Computations necessary to get those features of known 20th century physics. And that's going spectacularly well.
Yeah, so says you. He says spectacularly well a lot. Everything's going spectacularly well. Lots of spectacularly well stuff happening. It's not happening anywhere near me. Yeah, I don't see any of that spectacularly well crap.
Now, can we predict things that weren't known from 20th century physics? Yes, we can. Unfortunately, many of those things require...
The expansion of the universe. I mean, again, just all based on just making up a story and saying, well, because the light is shifted, therefore the objects, there must be new space being created between the photons, you know, that's, you know, causing the frequency to change. It couldn't be that the objects are actually moving a speed away from each other, and it certainly couldn't be that the photons are interacting with something in the space, when we already know that, of course, they're interacting with something in the space because the space isn't completely empty, because we know it has crap in it. We know the hydrogen and the helium on the Earth, trapped in the Earth, are drifting into space. We know it happens. There's stuff in the empty space. Not much of it, but it's there.
Scale parameter. So, for example, when Einstein was thinking about the cosmological constant, he didn't know how big it would be. We still don't completely know how big it is. But it's an extra parameter in the theory, an extra number you have to put in. So for us, we have one extra number, which is the maximum entanglement speed in physical space.
Okay, the maximum entanglement speed. So this is just, I mean, you're just saying, okay, so what's the foundational logic that gives you some indication that there is something about the physical universe that allows faster than light anything? That anything is doing this faster than light thing, this instantaneous teleportation thing? I mean, you really don't have any evidence that this is real.
The maximum speed that information can propagate at is the speed of light. In our branchial space of quantum states, the maximum speed information can propagate at is this thing we call maximum entanglement speed. We call it zeta. And it has, so we don't know its value. We've got a rough estimate that its value might be 10 to the 5 solar masses per second.
10 to the 5 solar masses per second, right? So he's basically using solar masses because he's giving mass a certain amount of spatial dimension. And so he's saying every bit of solar mass is 4 centimeters in space. And so you're just doing distance by turning it into a mass unit. And so, the calculation is something, you know, he could have stated it in light years, but he just, no, I won't bother.
It's in funny units because it's a funny kind of quantity. We don't know that value. If we knew that value, we could make immediate predictions about all kinds of things. So with that value.
Yeah, okay. Could be predicting what? Predicting what exactly would he predict? You know, I mean, he would predict the answer to questions that there's just no way we would see anyway. I mean, it's just, there's nothing to predict. He'll predict when a photon is, going to be, whatever the word is for when it's de-entangled. The whole entanglement theory, again, is just another theory. We're just saying, how can anybody believe this Schrodinger cat kind of crap, right? Because the idea is that somehow, because nothing's looking at the cat, the cat's in two states. But we know that looking doesn't mean much, right? There's x-rays, there's cosmic rays, there's all kinds of things that are looking all the time. They're taking pictures. Yeah, there's no camera, but the idea is that you could take a picture of the cat with lots of different other kinds of energy. And the energy that's the easiest one, the one that's all over the place, is gravity. So as long as the cat's in gravity, it's being constantly de-entangled. It can't have a superimposed state anymore because it's been outed by gravity itself. So there is no time to be entangled. You don't get to just be in a state and nothing interacts with you. That never happens. Doesn't even happen for an electron. It doesn't happen for anything in this stupid universe where, oh yeah, you just spend some time all by yourself. I mean, it does happen for the electron. I mean, you know, one kazillionth of a second between the little bits hitting it, you know, where nothing's hitting it. But this is just such crap.
We can make predictions about black hole mergers, the rate at how black hole mergers can happen, deviations from what happens in Einsteinian gravity around black holes, a bunch of different predictions for that. But those predictions depend on this parameter.
Yeah, right. And you're going to prove the predictions with what? A photograph of the black hole, which isn't a photograph. It's completely synthetic and made up by a software. Like, this guy's an information technologist. He knows that you can do anything. You can manipulate information in so many ways. So, I mean, you could take the pixels in this video and you could rearrange them by some algorithm. And then you can have another algorithm analyze the positions of the randomized photons. And it could prove, okay, that I'm not a person and, you know, this whole thing. It could say that it most looks like, you know, a squirrel in a tree with an acorn. You know, there could be that it would actually prove that that's what it's a picture of because that's what it most matches. You know, it's just arbitrary. You can just select anything to find. You can find anything you want in dense enough information is the truth. And that's all this crap is about. So anyway, I think we've heard enough, right? Well, we could play a little bit more, but it's not going anywhere good.
We can also potentially make predictions about quantum computers if we know that parameter. We can show things about the extent to which quantum computers can work. It may still be the case that what we're seeing in labs for quantum computers is miles and miles away from the theoretical prediction limits and so on. I don't know. There are potentially some predictions.
He doesn't seem too keen. You know, he actually points out how, you know, quantum computers, it takes more time to process the data that they produce because it's in such a crappy form. And so it'll never really function faster than a regular computer because it takes so long to be able to analyze what it produces as an output. That it doesn't matter that it's faster because it's much slower in terms of it doesn't speak the right language. Being able to interpret what it's saying, so to speak. So yeah, it gets the answer much quickly, but it draws it so badly, the number 7 or whatever, 8, 10, whatever the answer is. It draws the answer so badly that you have to take so much time to figure out what it actually drew.
That can be made that are scale independent, that don't depend on these extra parameters. Ironically enough, I think one of them might have to do with photons in orbit around a black hole. So it's very much the same as Einstein's idea about we've got light going around a star, but this is a little bit more ornate because there's actually photons trapped in orbit around a black hole.
Right, and so that would also have to be some sort of perfect orbit, which doesn't make much sense, and it would be a tiny, thin orbit if it was even possible to have a photon orbit. So, the whole thing. But, you know, the whole idea, do you people really believe that photons are captured and they can't go somewhere because they're being pulled by the gravity? Oh, come on.
And there is some reason to believe that when you have pairs of photons trapped in that kind of orbit, that they will have certain quantum correlations that simply weren't there in Einstein's theory of gravity.
Whatever. I think I've had enough. Okay, yeah, we'll call this a video. All right, so till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot. Oh, God, I'm so depressing. So, this has been a draftphysics.com debate physics also, but there's just nobody to debate. Nobody will defend. Nobody will respond to the accusation that you have no evidence that it's 1/2 mv² and levers and any pressure device will prove that 1/2 mv² is nonsense because everything becomes a free energy device. And you never redid the Eddington experiment. You haven't proven that photons are even bent by light, bent by gravity, let alone bent twice as much. The lensing images from space, the little pictures of smiley faces and whatnot are mathematically all broken. They all have huge flaws. They don't make much sense. Why do you believe? Anyway. So, till the next time. And so forth and whatnot.